Tapes and Scouts, a podcast where two friends review every single movie they watch.
Welcome, everybody, to another Capes and Scouts special.
Whoa.
We have an interview.
Whoa.
We got an interview.
Whoa.
And Max is here to help me.
Hi.
Hi, Max. And today, you may recall on Tapes and Scouts recently, we talked about a specific movie involving a crazed killer sofa.
And if you don't remember, you better remember. Stop right now. Go listen to that episode.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
It is.
But with us today is the director of said movie, Bernie Rao. Bernie, how are you?
I'm all good, thanks. Thank you for having me on, for the opportunity to talk a little bit about this crazy film.
So much fun. Before we go into Killer Sofa, because we're going to hammer Killer Sofa pretty hard. First, how are you? And definitely let people know, on. We always do it at the top and the end, let people know where they can find you on social media.
Well, on social media, I guess I'm on Twitter. I just opened Twitter for the film.
Nice.
And I can be found at Bernie Rao on Facebook, I suppose. And if you Google my name, you see all the stuff that I do, Vimeo and all some other things, music.
Nice.
Yeah, I guess Google. Google is your best friend here, I suppose.
You're not wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my very first question has to be, why killer sofa and not recliner chair? What was the decision there? Is sofa, is a recliner a sofa in New Zealand? What were they like?
No, in New Zealand, it's called the Lazy Boy. It's a recliner, obviously. And the movie was always called, until the last moment, My Lover, My Lazy Boy. That was the title I wanted to have.
Wow.
But yeah, my lover, my lazy boy, because the movie, obviously, that's obviously not a sofa, and that's obviously not killer sofa doesn't represent what the movie is, I think, but it has how it ended up being killer sofa. Well, it's a long story, but making it very short, it was the distributor in America just chose that title because they thought the movie would sell better. And I'm like, you know, this is a no-budget film, right? I'm there, and I decided, okay, I'll trust these guys. I mean, they sell films, and I surely want to try to make some money with it. So they said, okay, let's go through various names. And I was in 10 minutes, I wrote like maybe 15 names, right?
Mm-hmm.
And among those names, I wrote Killer Sofa, so it was on me. It was my bad, right? And that's what they chose. You know, like, I went to do another film, and suddenly I see the poster, I see everything, and everything was Killer Sofa. And I'm like, all right, I guess, they know what they're doing. So that was it, you know.
I mean, I disagree.
It was not
your title's way better.
Yeah.
Yeah, your title is way better. I agree.
Yeah, it was more art house, because I always saw this movie as an art house film when I was making it. You know, it was, of course, it's a recliner killing people, but that was the challenge, right? Can I make a story work with this stupid concept, right? And that's what kept me going. Like, okay, the challenge and the troubleshooting of trying not to sink the ship, try to get it to land with this stupid concept. And it was good. I mean, that's challenging and that's interesting.
That's definitely true. So,
yeah.
So what is the origin of the killer sofa idea? Was it just like, this is silly, let's see if I can do it?
Yeah, no, it was like, this is my fourth feature film, right? I made three feature films before,
mm-hmm.
and they're all very unsuccessful. And, I was looking for a horror idea. I wanted to make a horror film. I love horror films. Dario Argento is one of my mentors. I love all his films, and Peter Jackson, obviously, and Carpenter and all of that. But so when I started looking for horror ideas, even though I was told in the market, man, make a straight horror because, you know, comedy horror, it doesn't work. It's very hard to sell, blah, blah, blah. I just, in that time period where I had to decide what film I would make, that was the best idea I had. It was like, I don't know, I was looking for an antagonist, and I was looking after a recliner that a friend left at my place, and I was like, oh man, this would be cool if this could be possessed by something, and that's all I have to say. Maybe it was a bad idea, but you know, 2 years after that, there was a movie about a killer recliner.
That's awesome.
I don't think it's a bad idea. Yeah. All ideas, you know, you just got to work them out and get to where you need to go.
I agree with you, man. It's like there are no bad ideas. It's like there are ideas, and then it's what you make of those ideas, right? I completely agree with you.
Absolutely. So I'm going to ask you now, when writing the script, did you know how to reach the ending as we saw it in the film, which I thought was great, by the way, or did you kind of like wing it and try to naturally fill in blanks? And I ask more because I feel like movies of all budgets tend to lack insight and explain everything as thoroughly as you did on this movie.
No, the answer to that is no. And it's has to do with shooting a no-budget film, right? Because you are, you know, you're compromising in a lot of things. It's, everything is changing all the time. You know, you just want to keep it going and to keep it interesting. And you do what you have to do to make some movie that works. And I wrote, the movie I wrote originally didn't have this ending. No, it had another ending, a more uplifting ending. But then as I started shooting and seeing the footage and then trying to resolve some problems that the story had that probably should have been fixed at script stage, that was a big problem, like finishing the film and then suddenly after weeks and weeks of thinking and trying different things, that was the ending that made sense in that universe, at least for me, right? And of course, filling the blanks was a big thing here, there. That's why I got that guru guy that comes on YouTube, right, and explains things that are happening that was not originally there. I had to put it there just to make the story work, just to get it to a place where it was like some sort of a satisfying end, I suppose. But, you know, I like it. I mean, I think it's pretty artsy. You know, I think it's pretty poetic in a way. And yeah, I think it kind of works for me. I don't know.
It worked. It worked for me.
Awful. Yeah. Thanks.
The character, the internet character. At what point, you were already in production when you added that character, or were you done and in post and seeing that you needed something to fill in those gaps?
Yeah, the movie had two phases, right? It was like I shot the movie in maybe 25 days or something like that.
Awesome.
And then I've edited part of the movie and I went to the market in America, to the American film market, trying to get distribution, because distribution is always the key, right? It's like you need to know where the film is going and you need to get a sales agent and you need to, you know, try to make deals, try to put the movie out there. Otherwise, I'll send it to my mom and my mom doesn't even want to watch horror movies. You know? So I went there and I realized, okay, I was looking for more money or some money to finish the film, but I couldn't get any money. So I came back to New Zealand. I decided to make it more slick, right? Because half the film was slick looking, but half was very rushed because I couldn't, you know, my crew was two people, right? It was me and the sound guy and a friend helping out with props and things. So I decided to make it more slick. And in that process, I realized the story was not working as it was. And then I had this friend called Greg Kiriyama, which is an amazing, you know, he's a star in New Zealand. He's like, he used to be a TV presenter and he hosts a radio show. And I thought, man, I had Greg because he has that charisma, right? He has that presence. And I thought, man, this guy maybe could help me. Maybe the rabbi could go online and check out some information about the books. And it ties everything in the end, right, in some way. So, it's like making a movie is like making a poem, right? You don't know where it's going. It was improvising, just winging it, I suppose.
Well, no, that's art.
You know,
that's true.
There are no formulas. You know, you start doing something and then it's troubleshooting until the end, until you decide to stop.
Yeah.
And that was what happened here, you know.
It's all problem solving. Right?
Thousands of decisions to get there.
Right, I'm sure.
But I'm glad you think it works, man. It's so good to hear.
I had a blast. Yeah. This is easily my favorite comedy horror movie. To have a movie just explain all the bullshit. I'm telling you, that's what I love. It's like, look, this is what this is. Clearly, this is about a killer piece of furniture. So let's make it make sense. Let's give you the best killer piece of furniture we can do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. I love that kind of stuff as well. Maybe we're alone in this in this opinion, but I just love that. That's, you know, I hate predictable things, even though this movie is predictable in a way. Yeah, that's what I was always trying to do, like trying to give something new or something interesting, something juicy. And sometimes, you know, has to do with exposition and just talking about a killer recliner with the most serious face you can put, right?
No, I think that's fair. And I think it's a good segue into a question I had. Speaking of juicy, the character of Ralph, how did you come up with that? What was your inspiration?
It had to do with like different versions of the script, and that character was a mix of two characters. I just had to show, I suppose, like a stalker, because this girl had this problem, right? It had, you know, she always had problems with guys. Mm-hmm. So I had to show like what type of problems she had. And I realized, oh man, this guy could be cool. You know, he comes into her house, she doesn't know he's there, he has cameras, he goes and has a, you know, a poo in her toilet, like, you know, like,
yep.
When she's not there, he's at home, because he does that every day. And I just thought that was hilarious, you know, but this time there's a killer sofa there, a recliner there, you know.
No, I think it was
And the recliner becomes the audience, right? It's the audience looking at that guy. That's what I like, the audience identifies with the recliner, I suppose. Yes,
yeah, it was so good. It caught me off guard when in the way you said it, and the way he acted so cavalier your direction to just kind of make him just do, like, he was great. He was a trio. I was like, what is this guy doing?
yeah, pretty casual, you know, just doing it. It's his house, man. Yeah. You know, when she's not there.
It's so good.
And I love this. This is detail. Maybe, you know, it's not obvious when he's about to, I guess, hump the bra. Mm-hmm. He kisses a cross, right? He has a cross in his pocket. Oh, man, I think that was James' idea. That was such a brilliant idea. Like, this little cross that he kisses, like, you know, all the, you know, maybe he's a religious guy. Who knows?
Yeah, it's great. Really good.
Yeah.
How does one go about casting a character that's supposed to be the sexy woman, has men, women falling all over? What qualities are you looking for? Because I imagine you casting a bunch of really beautiful women, and you're just like, no, not you, not you. And you're just, what were you looking for, per se?
This is like, that character was a very difficult character, because she's supposed to be very, like, not very intelligent, very bright, right? But then in the end, you need to have that plot twist, right, where she becomes the Valerie, right? Okay, which is another type of woman. And I knew this character would have to be a caricature, you know. So Pimu, May, the actress that I chose, she has that factor. I don't know, that made it work for me. You know, like the way she would look at you with those blank eyes. And I went through a few actors, I mean, but you have to understand, this is a no-budget film. So everybody that came to the casting session, I would tell them, look, there's no payment. You know, I can give you some food, and I can pick you up from work or home, and we come and we shoot the film. So that immediately limits all the, you know, the talent I can have available. It's more like, who is available to do this? And then I work with that, right? So Pimu, this was her first film. I think she did great. I mean, I love her to death. She did an amazing job there, you know. And of course, she was nervous because she's actually a dancer and she's a performer. She's an artist, but she never did anything like this. And we just work it out, you know, like try things until we reach the sweet spot of performance, right?
Right.
So that's how we got her. You know, I saw a video of her doing some impersonation on YouTube. I didn't know her. And I contacted her and say, look, I think you would be great for this role if you want to, you know, try to do it. It's just, you know, it's a killer recliner.
Well, that's good. That's good, though. That really proves, you know, just to go for it with things and just ask. You lose nothing by asking. You know?
Exactly. I mean, you can ask. And I asked many people, you know, many actors in New Zealand, more, you know, famous actors, and I send them emails. But most people just don't come back to you, or they just say, you know, do I really want to do this? Except Jed Brophy. Jed was the star, right? Jed is the most known actor in our film. He is the Inspector Gravy. Mm-hmm. He, you know, is a buddy of Peter Jackson, and he's in all the Peter Jackson films, and he's a professional actor. And man, he came on board like, I want to give independent filmmakers something, right? So he was a champ, you know, and because of him, I got other things going because I had him attached to the film. And awesome. But you know, It's like I say, this is really like a backyard indie. It's like this is a no budget film. It looks great. And I think it looks great. I really put a lot of effort there. When you're actually producing something like this, it doesn't exist yet. So people don't know what it's going to be. And it's not easy to approach Jermaine Clement or like a famous actor and say, look, I have no money, but I'm making this. Do you want to be on my film?
Right.
You know, so, that was it.
So how many different chair designs did you originally have? I know you said it was a low budget movie, but were you like really concerned on the way the chair looked? Did you want it to be like grotesque? Or I like that it was a little more simple and that it looked like just a regular chair.
No, this was like, okay. When I decided to make a movie about the killer recliner, of course, the movie didn't exist yet. And I started looking for other recliners online, right? I was like, okay, I'll go on Trade Me, which is eBay, sort of eBay here in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And I started going through recliners, like seeing if something would spark my imagination, you know, would give me some kind of idea of what the movie could be. And I found this recliner, right? With that face, and I immediately saw that mopey face, right? And I put two little buttons for eyes, and I'm like, man, that's it. You know, that worked for me because it's like that mopey face. You can do something so much with that. You know, I knew in the editing I could make that face be expressive, even though the face never changes. The significance of the scene changes, right? It's like the Kuleshov effect, like the Russian guy in the 20s, he came up with this idea of how to tell, you know, like if you put shots in sequence, it gained a special meaning. You can create storytelling by putting different shots together, right?
Right.
So I guess I used that technique, you know, like that recliner, it's just basically a real recliner with two buttons for eyes. There's not much to it. And it's like, of course, I had to put a light in those eyes to make it a bit more expressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I played around with some ideas like LED lights and coming from inside the recliner. But that was so expensive. And not expensive, but difficult and not practical. So the most practical thing was always have a light pointing at the recliner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, it needs to be in a special angle, but I would most times I would operate the camera and I would have this kind of torch or flashlight pointing at the recliner so I could see the eyes move, right? Or I could see some light in these eyes because everything was practical, all the effect, you know, I didn't do anything with, you know, post-production VFX, anything like that. So, yeah, it's a simple trick, man. It's like, I think I saw that trick with on the behind-the-scenes movie of The Lights Out.
Yep.
I suppose the horror movie.
Yep, that's a
damn and David sure. Sandberg was like saying, "Oh, that's how we did it." You know, sometimes we just shine, you know, threw a light at the character. And I'm like, yeah, that actually worked, you know. And I'm a cinematographer, so I know it's always good to have light in people's eyes, just to give that spark in their eyes.
Right.
And so I had to treat the recliner with some, you know, dignity and have that there as well.
You just used the one chair across the whole production.
Yeah, I could only afford one chair. That chair cost me $100. And it was a good investment. But I couldn't do a lot of things I wanted. Like I had this scene where the recliner jumped from a balcony just to kill a guy. And I did a test and I broke something in the recliner. I'm like, oh, man, I cannot do this. So, because I had to shoot and, you know, I had to use that recliner throughout the movie. So there was a lot of stuff I wanted to do, but I just couldn't because it would risk just, damaging the recliner, which I couldn't. You know, in the end of the movie, the mouth started getting really deformed because I would put smoke through the mouth and we would put our hand through the mouth just to make it move.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you can see sometimes the mouth is like really, really strangely shaped. That's because, you know, it started getting really deformed.
So speaking of the chair specifically, I just wanted to know if there was any inspirations for your choices. One of my favorite things, the thing that immediately caught me, and I was just, because Tim went to the podcast, like, you got to see this. So I was like, all right, I'll watch it. And one of the things that immediately struck me, I was like, I love what this guy's doing, is the first really dramatic push in for the chair, where it's just like, you push in, there's a little sting, and it's like, he's like a person's reaction shot. For that? Like, what brought that on? Was, like, were you trying to mimic anything, or was that just like out of your head for that kind of thing?
So that scene came as a pickup shot, right? Because I needed a scene where I could introduce the recliner, because the recliner is really the star of the show, right? So I had to have him in this kind of I don't know, dignified appearance, right? So I thought, man, the recliner in a garage with some smoke and some chains around it for no reason. I go, why would chains be there? Just to make it look cool, right? Really, there's nothing to it. And then that scene when the guy looks at the recliner and the recliner looks back and there's that push in. It's just to create some kind of evil, feeling.
Yeah.
It's like you see movies like Christine by Carpenter, yes, or whatever. And Christine has a similar scene, right? It's mm-hmm. like you see the car in the factory and some guy just gets killed in the car.
Yep.
Right. So you introduce the idea that this thing is evil. So that was it. I mean, the way to finish the scene, of course, I had to finish. I couldn't just finish with the girl just leaving the place. You know, I had to finish with this guy's face looking at the thing, thinking, what the hell is going on here with this thing? You know, and the little eyes and the mouth. And, you know, he tried different things, and that was the best thing.
That was great.
I could find.
Paid off. Yeah. I'm glad you named Christine because it's one of my favorite Carpenter movies. And I was like, oh, man.
Oh, man. So good, right? Bed to the Bone, isn't it? I think that's the song they play.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah. Christine was a big influence. I suppose when I was making the film, then I went to see what kind of other film exists, like in this universe, right? And of course, there's Rubber. I love Rubber.
Me too.
The film with the tire, it's yes. genius, you know. And Christine, of course, man. And when you see the trailer and they're talking about the car, like that car, mm-hmm. you know, since he got that car, he hasn't been the same.
Yes.
You know, I just love that kind of stuff. I mean, isn't it fun?
Okay. Right? Totally agree.
And because that was the thing with me. I immediately realized, okay, this movie can go two ways, right? It can be Sharknado way, like, or, you know, the killer condom or the killer refrigerator way, which is like, okay, this is just a goofy film. You know, let's be goofy and let's make everything goofy. And it, you know, it's a spoof of sorts. But I just couldn't do it, man. I just had to do something, you know, with more class. I suppose, I guess that's because I'm a cinematographer and I like to make things look pretty. And if you want to make it look pretty, you can't just be goofy because it doesn't make sense, right? It needs to be rough, right? If you want it to be goofy and in that world. Anyway, just finding the right tone, it's very difficult. And it was a difficult thing throughout the movie, you know, to knowing what works and what doesn't. And I cannot tell you why it works and why it doesn't. You just have to look at it and feel it. Right. And you feel, I shot a lot more scenes that didn't work because I couldn't make it fit in that universe. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized, you know, treating it as a serious horror film was the best way to go. It was funnier, I suppose. Even though the movie ended up being a bit too serious in the end, and that has to do with, I think, the music that we put there.
Mm-hmm.
Because the music was made by the guy that made was my sound guy, James Dunlop. He's an artist, this guy. He's a great guy. He was there from beginning to end. It was my crew, basically, him and a friend of mine from Portugal. He is a musician as well. And he said, man, I would like to try to make music for this film. And I'm like, well, if you can make music, that would be great. Because I thought I would make the music myself. You know, but he wanted to make the music, and I'm like, dude, let's do it. And then he went to his garage for 2 months, and he came out from that garage, and he said, here's the music. And I'm like, the only note I gave him before he made the music was like, James, let's make this like a horror film, a true horror film. So make it, you know, serious. But then I realized, oh, man, this is too serious. You know, this is like, it's kind of, I want it to be more like in the world of Tim Burton. Sometimes, you know, a little bit more fantastic. But then I realized this guy couldn't change things because it was so much work. So we just made some adjustments here and there just to make it less of a straight horror, I suppose. But it ended up being really almost like a straight horror soundtrack.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, the soundtrack, you know. And, you know, it works, you know, in some way or form. It's doing the thing.
Yeah. It does a nice job of hanging the hat on the funny moments, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you're a good man, because I would have given him the note that you could only write the music while sitting in a recliner.
Yeah. I think he had the recliner, actually, at that point. You know?
That's how that music came out so good.
Uh-huh. That's right. He was possessed.
Yeah, he was possessed by the recliner. No, it's a great song. It's a great soundtrack. You know, it's an amazing man. You did an amazing job there.
How did you get the money together for the film? What was like the bulk of your production cost?
Well, I was working as at the time I was working as a cameraman for a news agency, right? On weekends, I would shoot parliament stuff and, you know, like rugby stuff. So I would make some money. Half the money was to pay the rent. Half was to just use in the movie. But this movie was very cheap to make. I mean, it looks like there's a lot of money, but, you know, basically that was the house where I was living. That was my recliner. I had the camera. I bought a few lights and a smoke machine. And that was it. You know, like, and you go week by week, you shoot a few days here, a few days there, and you build this thing. It was like, it was not a, you know, I didn't go look, you know, talk with financiers and try to pitch the idea of a killer recliner movie. I mean, no, it was not like that. It's funny to think like that could happen, right? Like an Ed Wood kind of story where a guy goes and meets with all these executives and, hey, I got this great idea, it's a killer recliner. And they're like, oh man, we got to make that movie. No, that, you know, at least not in New Zealand. New Zealand, there's no money for horror films at all, right? So if this movie wanted to exist, if this movie was to exist, I would have to do it myself. And that's what I did. I mean, you know, like the money is really on screen because nobody got paid. And I mean, thinking about where I spent the most money on this film was probably distribution, like, you know, making sure I had insurance for the film and I had deliverables like hard drives and things like that. But yeah, it just goes to show that, you know, any guy like me can pick up a camera and shoot a film. There's really no secrets to it. Not anymore, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, there was really no money. I mean, you know, I could, normally people like to say, oh, yeah, the movie cost $100,000 because then they want to sell it for $200,000 or $300,000, right? Like Hollywood movies say, oh, it costs $20 million, but it doesn't cost $20 million. It costs like $7 million, right? Because they have the props, they have the stages, they have all of that. But that's how they make money. But right. When at this level, why to say that? You know, it doesn't make sense. You know, it costs what it costs.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah. I'm really happy that the movie got where it is right now, because at this level, it's like piercing through obscurity. It's the most difficult thing, right? There are so many movies being made every year all over the planet because everybody has these cameras. This is not a special camera. This is just a Blackmagic camera. It costs maybe $1,000. You know, so everybody's making films all the time, right? And when you go to the market trying to sell the film, you see hundreds of films like yours, thousands, you know, and you think, man, how am I going to pierce through all this noise? And just getting distribution and getting the movie out there, talking with you guys now, it's already a victory for something that was not, you know, planned ahead. I did plan ahead in terms of, okay, let me pick up a genre that I can actually get it out there and trying to get the best actors I can, trying to best the best look I can. But after a while, it's a bit of luck and a bit of, you know, being able to finish the film. The movie almost didn't get finished because I dropped my hard drive at some point and I lost like maybe 4 months of editing.
Okay.
And it was heartbreaking. I almost lost, you know, I thought, for a week or two, I decided I'm just not going to finish this because it's too much work just to go back and re-edit the film, which was like a full-time job almost, right?
Right.
But then I decided, man, all these actors that worked for free, I really need to finish this. So I just had to go back and re-edit the whole thing. And the movie was already finished at that point. It was just so stupid. So learning, you know, do backups, I suppose. That was the lesson here.
Right. So what are you proudest of now that Killer Sofa is kind of making its rounds all over? And if you could go back and change something specific, what would it be?
If I could change something, I don't know, because it's hard to say, because, you know, for sure I would have a backup of that hard drive, man. For sure, because that thing was heartbreaking. But anyway, if I could change something, maybe I would change distribution. I would try to self-distribute myself, but that's a hard thing
right.
to do because I didn't make any money with the film yet, right? I never got any money. The movie's out there. It was pirated, and the pirating is not the problem. The problem is the legacy model of distribution for producers like me, right? Who, you know, we don't really have a lot of things going for us. We just have to show up with the film and the sales agents and distributors are like, man, we have 20 films. So we give you a crappy deal. And if you want it, it's yours. If you don't, well, good luck.
Yep.
You know, so I had to accept this crappy deal and the movie, you know, had to go out there and do its thing. And I guess I would try to self-distribute if I knew what I know now, right?
Right.
And if the situation were, because this is changing all the time, like the way movies get sold and get bought and are bought and sold. And so yeah, it's hard to say. Maybe I wouldn't change a thing, you know. That's fair. Yeah. I don't know. I cannot think in those terms. Like, if I could go back, maybe I would have bought another recliner to try to do more spectacular scenes, I suppose. But the movie is what it is, you know. Some people like it. I wish it had better reviews. It's a bit heartbreaking. Sometimes I go on IMDb or Letterboxd and I see, 2 stars, man. You know, like, come on. 5 star, you know, like, I'm not asking for 5 stars, but at least half the way there.
Yeah.
Like, 2.5 stars or 3 stars.
I agree.
Sometimes I see people that are like, oh, man, this movie was so entertaining. I laughed my head out. 1 star.
Yep.
And I'm like, what's going on here? But in a way, I don't blame them because I think this has to be with how the movie was presented to people, right? And it's presented as a movie that is supposed to be so bad it's good, I guess, you know?
Sure.
So you are expecting a certain type of film and your mind is already, you know, like, okay, I know already what I'm going to write about this movie before I see the movie. And some people are able to overcome that because the movie surprises them. Like, oh my God, this was actually a different type of movie. And they are able to make that change, right? That click. And some people just don't. You know, they had the preconceived idea of what the movie was going to be. And the movie was something else that entertained them in the way, but they're just write what they were going to write when they saw the trailer or the poster, you know. Right. But I'm okay with that. Look, the movie is being, you know, people are seeing the movie and I'm already happy about that. You know, the movie is getting out there. That's what we wanted, you know. So bad reviews, good reviews. I mean, people taking the time to write the review is already awesome for me.
Right.
Know?
Right. Don't get down on the reviews, man. We do 4 movie reviews a week and we see this all the time where I'm like, what were they thinking when they reviewed? Like it never lines up.
No.
And it boggles the mind. So don't bother you. But
I don't read reviews anymore. I mean, I just, I see reviews. Sometimes I want to post things because it's good for the actors, right? And it's good, you know, just to promote the film.
Right.
But I used to read when the movie came out, I was reading every review and I'm like, oh man, this is heartbreaking because people get things wrong all the time. And oh, this is an Australian film and they call it Sofas There and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm not going to read anything. You know, if it's a good review, only if somebody like my partner says, hey, you should read this because this is actually good. And I go and read because of course you feel good. When I think I heard your podcast, I saw your podcast. Mm-hmm. And when I saw it, because I have these alerts, right? Everything Killer Sofa comes to my email. So I see, okay, these guys have a podcast. I listen to a little bit to it and I'm like, oh, it's so cool. They loved it. Of course, it's awesome to hear that, you know, but you know, you got to get the good things and the best things in it. I understand, you know, some people won't like it,
right.
And some people love it. But thanks, guys. Great, man. Great that you guys loved it.
You're welcome. I'm going to keep telling people to watch it.
Oh, man, you're a star, you're a legend. You even bought a couple of t-shirts. Didn't you buy a t-shirt? You bought a t-shirt.
I did buy a t-shirt.
Nice.
You're a legend, man. Yeah, t-shirt is pretty cool. I have a t-shirt, man. I go to the supermarket, everybody looks at me funny, you know, like, you know.
That's exactly what I wanted. I bought a t-shirt. I picked the pink t-shirt because I want it to look like a happy t-shirt, and then that thing's on the front of it.
But yeah, you know, just shows the type of person you want to be in this world, right? You want to go against the flow or you want to go with the flow, you know? Yeah. You know, I'm always against the flow, man. If people are running one way, I'll probably run the opposite just to see what's going on, you know, like, but that's me, you know?
How much fun was it to make Killer Sofa? Give it a grade, 1 to 10. What was, because I know you had your ups, your downs, your issues making it.
-1 for the hard drive loss.
Right.
Yeah. Look, I love this. I love this. I absolutely love making films. That's why I keep making them. And it was very, you know, it was hilarious. It was fun. You know, like all these things that I'm talking about, it has to do with not being there, because what I do enjoy about the process is the grind, right? Just going there and shooting and getting with the actors and setting up the camera. It's fun, man. It's a fun thing to do. That's why people do it. And that's why there are so many no budget films. Mm-hmm. And that's why people keep making them, because it's, you know, it's a social thing. everybody's having fun. Of course, there's up and downs in everything. There are up and downs, and especially something like a feature film, which is really a marathon. You know, there always comes a time in the middle of the journey where I think, man, this is a lot of work. This is not fun anymore, you know, because one thing is showing up on set and shooting with the actors, and that's fun there. But when you think that you're going to be 2 years with this thing, right, on your hard drive and editing and putting the music and putting the color and everything, you know, it just becomes a bit of it is what it is. You know, it has its fun moments and its sad moments, but it's sad and beautiful to make films. That's right. What I think. And the actors had a blast, of course. Everybody had a blast.
Good.
Me, I was a bit more stressed sometimes because there was no crew, like I said, so the actors needed the sushi. I would have to run to the car, run to the sushi store to get sushi, right? There's no like production assistant where I can just say, hey, just go and get some sushi, or, you know. So sometimes I would not have time to mingle and to, you know, have fun with the actors. Most times they were just having fun themselves.
Right.
Man, it's always fun, you know, making a film. And for me, I treat my set as almost like making a film is like organizing parties, right? You're organizing a party for Friday night, you know, like, hey, man, we're going to have fun. It's going to be drinks. It's going to be food. And it's going to be people there. And we're going to have some fun. Of course, we're shooting a movie. But I want people to be in that environment where they are happy. You know, they're having a great time. I hate when things get stressful. And I used to get stressed in my first film, too. But no, not anymore, man. It's like, there's no, you know, the benefit you get from stress and being, you know, stressed. It doesn't pay off in the end. Like, I cannot push the actors to do something in that day or night thinking that it will be worth it. Like, I don't get Kubrick about it. Like, oh, let's just do this because it's art. Now, if I see that, you know, somebody has a headache or things are not really fun anymore or they're starting to hurt a bit, I just say, well, we just couldn't do it. That's it, you know. I understand when there's a lot of money involved where you have to do things, that's different. But the way I do make films, yeah, I can always just decide, okay, let's stop here and then we'll do this next week or we'll do this tomorrow or we'll do this whatever, you know. And people know what they sign up for. Like when these actors knew that this was going to take a bit longer because we would shoot for less hours. This is not one of those situations where you have 10 days to make a film and you only have those people there for 10 days. No, I wrote the story so I could be shooting this for a longer period, but I only needed one actor for 3 hours every day. You know, that's how I imagined the production, right? Because that's also a creative thing, just how to make this work and how to, you know, write a story that you can shoot by yourself. Only you, a camera, an actor, and a guy doing the sound, you know.
Makes sense.
So you cannot do everything you wanted, you know. But that's good. Limitations are good, you know, when you're making a film.
Right. You don't want to burn yourself.
Sorry. Maybe I'm getting too geeky or too nerdy in the filmmaking process. Maybe, you know, you want some more general stuff.
No, I think it's a good thing. I mean, I'm digging it. But I do special makeup effects and I trying to work on my own first feature. So this is all, I'm just drinking it all in.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. You're a filmmaker. Okay. You're making a film.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great, man. What is the film about?
It's an anthology horror movie.
Oh, okay.
So I'm doing the same thing you are now, working through production, like, oh, should we shoot it in little pieces? And I'm working with the Screen Actors Guild right now, and we got approval to shoot in little pieces and everything. So.
Yeah. The guilds, man. In New Zealand, we don't have that, but the low budget and the, you know, I know that. I shot a film in LA. I was a cinematographer there. And they had problems with that. And you have to pay actors a certain fee. And that's when things get expensive. And I understand that, you know.
Yeah.
It's good luck, man. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, ways around it, I suppose. Like, that's how I think. It's like you can do a lot in the editing with actors that are not experienced, right? It's because if you have an actor like, I don't know, let's say, I'll just throw some name, Bruce Willis, okay? You put Bruce Willis with some crappy text and you say, hey, Bruce, can you say this? And he's going to say it in a way that will be interesting because he will find a way, because that's 20 years of experience right there, right? He just looks at those words and he makes something out of those words. Like John Lennon, if you give him a tuba, he'll get you something out of it, right? Mm-hmm. But when you have actors that don't have any experience and they look at the things you wrote and you can see them trying to figure out what they can do, sometimes it's better if they don't even talk, you know? But you can, I guess you just have to go with it. It's just like, okay, this guy can do this, but he can't do that. You just find a sweet spot and you play with that.
Right.
You know, so I believe there are not bad actors, you know, they're just bad direction. You know, you just see what they can do because they are people, you know, they have something to give you and you have to roll with the punches. You just realize, okay, this is not going to work. So this is the character this person is going to be. Of course, you never know what the movie is going to be in the end. Right. That's fun. That's interesting as well. Right.
Yeah.
Start making your film. You have this vision of what the movie could be. But then what the movie ends up being is something else, something completely different. And sometimes surprises you in a good way, you know.
Absolutely.
As long as it's not boring.
Well, definitely. Would you make a sequel to the Killer Sofa movie?
Oh, yeah. I've been trying to make a sequel and I have ideas. And I was going to Belgium to pitch the movie to investors because the movie got accepted at the Brussels International Fantastic Film Festival, which was great. We were going to have a screening there and I was going to the markets there and I had some meetings with distributors and sales agents and I had this idea for a sequel already. And but then COVID came and I got stuck in Australia. We lost our flights. We lost basically our tickets. And that was gone. You know, so now I'm trying to organize things and trying to think what could I do? You know, where could the movie go? I think maybe I would like to be more spectacular. You know, I'm learning a bit of special effects, visual effects now, and trying to make things a bit more, I guess, sellable in the end of the day and a bit more interesting because, you know, to make this viable, you know, it's 2 years of your life doing something like this, right? And I'm probably going to invest myself in the movie unless some financier comes and says, hey, let's make a proper film. So far, I didn't get any phone calls, right? So yeah, I'm considering a sequel. I'm just trying to think what could I do? What could I execute, basically, like with the resources I have? And it's interesting. I'm thinking about it. If you have any ideas, let me know.
I think you should call the sequel your original name. I think you should stick to that.
Oh yeah,
that name was great.
Yeah,
My Lover, My Lazy Boy.
Yeah,
and then my sound guy came with a movie was great with the title, which was great. It was called The Furnishing.
Oh,
The Furnishing, like The Conjuring. You know, like The Furnishing was amazing.
That is great.
And that was the title I said to the sales agent, look, you don't want My Lover, My Lazy Boy, and I understand because I also was concerned with Lazy Boy the brand.
Right.
Maybe they would sue us or, I don't know, maybe could be some problems there. So I said, let's call it The Furnishing. That's my title. But then here are 10 titles, including Killer Sofa. And look, I understand that the distributor is High Octane Pictures and the movies they sell is like Big Ass Spider. And, you know, there are like, those are the types of films they do. It's like Asylum, right? They have that type of audience right. And the audience expects a type of film coming from them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, yeah, Killer Sofa. I go on. That's what it is. You know, like I say, you don't know how the cookie crumbles at this level. Right. It just, I guess I have to be optimistic and think, hey, at least, you know, some people really hate the title, but at least maybe they watched the movie because of the awful title or the title. You know, who knows?
Well, I'm glad you're clearing your name and you're getting it out there that wasn't your, well, it was your fault, but it wasn't your fault.
Yeah.
it wasn't your fault.
Well, it was my fault. It was my fault. You know, yeah. I suggested the title, so it was my fault. Yeah, so.
Well, I think we're going to wind down here. I think we should have you back on at a later time to talk filmmaking and a lot of other things. I've got so many more things I could talk about, but I think we're going to end cap it here. We talked a lot about this Killer Sofa. I love the Killer Sofa. I have one more request. Next of you though, can you just say hello? Can you just say hello to my mother-in-law Rosa, because I made her watch this movie and she also she loves it.
She loves it, Rosa. Thank you so much. It's people like you that keep me going, man. Thank you so much for watching, and hopefully you can watch the sequel as well. You know, and I won't let you down.
Nice,
that's awesome, man.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on, and we'll be in touch. We'll do this again. I would love to talk some more film-oriented things with you later.
Yeah.
That'd be really fun.
Sure, I have 5 films I can go through, and I'll tell you everything that happens with those films. And yeah, another episode.
The master.
We'll so thank you, guys. It was great talking to you, man.
You as well.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Yeah.